Always record episode 134 with Zenor from Group Name for Grape Juice and Wally Sherold from Fine Just Fine.
One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them. One ring to bring them all. And in the darkness bind them.
Do we have Zenor on the line?
Hey guys.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good. Almost. Getting there.
Are you over your hangover?
I had a bath and I've got a pot of tea here, so
ooh,
getting better.
That sounds good. I kind of want a pot of tea,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, Wally. It's our first time, so nice to meet you.
Yeah, likewise. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah. Yeah,
did you ever talk to Jerry Fialka?
I haven't yet. No, we couldn't arrange a time, so we're doing it next weekend.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, that was a trip.
I listened to part of that. He sent me a link just to give me a sort of idea of what he's going to ask.
Yeah, he has kind of his general list of questions that I had a kind of a similar experience. He sent me an interview from earlier this year, and it was very similar, like all of the questions he was asking. So.
Yeah, you did a great job at answering those questions.
Thank you.
I was impressed by your answers. I don't know how I'll do in that kind of style of interview. You know, it's pretty intense in a way.
Is this publicly available somewhere? Your interview on?
Yes, it is. It's on archive.org, I think. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's also that's actually my recording that I did of the interview, and he's allowing me to do I'm going to make an episode of Fine Just Fine where the tables are turned and I'm the guest and he's the host. So, but from that material.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, here it is.
Yeah.
Here it is. And speaking of that, I just confirmed, on November 11th, 11/11, I'm going to interview Bob Dobbs. So.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. We've been trying to talk to each other as well.
Yeah. He mentioned that to me, that he's been in touch with you.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been in contact through various means, but, we've been trying to arrange a Skype call, but, the schedule hasn't worked out quite yet. I think it's going to be maybe in a couple weekends.
Okay.
We talk together.
Yeah, he and I reconnected after falling out of touch for almost a year, and he ended up calling me. I guess it was the day Gail Zappa died, so it was October 7th, and he hadn't heard yet, so that turned into a big part of our discussion, but.
Yeah, he actually mentioned that he talked to you, and that was what you discussed to me. He sent a little message saying that. He said he had a great talk with you.
Great, yeah. He's, man, what a character that guy is.
Yeah, he's incredible. I don't, I've heard about him over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to you guys talk, you and Alan, talk about your experience of finding him, which is amazing, right, through the Frank Zappa interview, right?
Right, right.
But no, I don't have a story that interesting. I just kept coming across his name over and over again, especially with Joyce, I guess.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I sort of come at this whole thing through Joyce, so.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, I've read a few of your blog posts, and but I was just, I don't know if this would be redundant for you, Alan, but I'm just kind of curious to know more about your background and how you got into the areas that you write so well about.
Yeah, so again, Joyce was another person who was on my radar for years, and I never got around to reading him. because I used to travel a lot, like sort of backpack around and hitchhike and do all that. So it was, I would just read books that would come to me kind of thing a lot of times. But I was always on the lookout for Joyce, especially for Finnegan's Wake, because I knew Robert Anton Wilson especially was into it, and Terence McKenna was into it, and like Tom Robbins is into it, and like everybody's into it. So I finally got a copy of it here in Japan a few years back, and first I read Ulysses, and then I just read tons of stuff about Finnegan's Wake and Joyce and everything that I could get my hands on about it. And then I plunged into the Wake, and it's hard to leave from there. That book has everything in it, right? So so that led to all kinds of different things, like back into William Blake and into Yeats and Ezra Pound, and then Wyndham Lewis and Eliot, and then finally from there, that course back into McLuhan. And yeah, it's like McLuhan, I've known about McLuhan for ages, I guess since the 90s, where there was kind of a McLuhan boom for a while. I don't know if you guys remember, but it was like with the onset of the internet, and people were saying that he had predicted it, and then like Wired magazine was quoting McLuhan all the time, and people were like, I had friends in university who were studying McLuhan, studies.
I've actually heard that the founder of Wired magazine cites McLuhan as like the entire basis for that, for why that magazine exists.
I think so. That's how it appeared when it first came out. Like they were constantly quoting McLuhan all the time. You know? Like, that was like the basis of the magazine. Was
right,
McLuhan.
Yeah, it would have been, for me, it would have been the late 90s, because I was first introduced to McLuhan in college. I went to music school, but had this one particular... Well, I went to Oberlin Conservatory, which is, you know, shares a campus, basically, in the middle of nowhere in Ohio with Oberlin College, which is a notoriously radical liberal arts college in the States. They were the first college in the United States to allow both women and African Americans back in the 1860s. So they can really lay claim to being the true radical liberal, well, the original liberal arts college, really. And I had this one course that was technically satisfying a music theory requirement, but it was called Trends in Contemporary Music, and it was taught by one of my composition professors, but it was very broad in its scope and had only really, I mean, there was very little actual like intense musical theory study. It was more like McLuhan, Umberto Eco's essays on semiotics. Scott McCloud was one of our required textbooks, Understanding Comics.
Wow.
Walter
that
Ben
should be a
sorry
required. As I'm saying, that should be a required text.
Oh yeah, it's an extraordinary book. Ways of Seeing by John Berger.
Right.
What else? Walter Benjamin and the Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. That essay.
I studied that essay as well.
So several of these kind of critical theory, staples, I guess you would call it. But McLuhan was, I think a couple of chapters from Understanding Media were part of our syllabus, and so that's when I first encountered him. But then he flew off my radar for many years, and it was, I think, when I discovered Bob Dobbs, because I had reopened all of my own personal research into Zappa, and that interview had always been kind of my holy grail, starting point for like taking the going beyond just like the surface of Zappa and his music, but really trying to understand his whole worldview and philosophy, which is just as dense as his musical output, really.
I really want to read that interview now.
It's extraordinary. And then when I understood that there was all of these ties to McLuhan, I dug out from my old filing cabinets all of my old papers that I kept from that class, and then just immersed myself in all things McLuhan. And within a matter of months, he was like up there on my list of like heroes. I just binged on him. I read as much as I could get my hands on.
It's easy to do, right?
There's so much, yeah. And it's just so fascinating.
Yeah, the university I went to in Canada, one of the professors there in my department, like I was taking cultural studies, but I didn't have him as a professor. I really wish now that I had him, But his name is Donald Thiel. You probably came across his stuff.
Donald Thiel? T-H-I-E?
Yeah.
Yeah, that name definitely rings a bell.
Looks like The All. Yeah, The All Thiel. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
He was one of McLuhan's top students.
Mm-hmm.
I think they wrote together even at some point. But yeah, he's written a ton of stuff on McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of my friends were studying under Thiel, even studying with Thiel, talking about McLuhan and Finnegan's Wake. A good friend who was studying that. But at that time, I wasn't into it. I was more into kind of French post-structuralism and that whole side, like Baudrillard and Derrida and
sure.
Foucault and all those guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't immediately get into McLuhan because I always associated him with a kind of like he's the prophet of the internet and he's the media guru and all this stuff. At that time, I was interested more in the critique of technology and media than the media itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I had always associated with like McLuhan as that.
It's easy to do that, I think, because on the surface, that's sort of the
exoteric view of McLuhan. That's
right.
Sort of the popular view of
that's him, a good right? way to so put it. Sure, sure.
If you're just looking at it from a surface level, that's what you get with McLuhan. Like everybody knows, the medium is the message and the global village and all these things, right?
Right.
It's like,
but the depth
but
with which
I know,
he has
to see McLuhan finally, just really recently, coming at McLuhan again through literature, right, and seeing him as an English literature professor, basically,
right.
And that's where he comes into his media analysis, right,
mm-hmm.
as an extension of literature, and it makes so much sense as that, you know.
Well, he sees it as this continuum, and I think I don't know if you're familiar, you know, with they recently published his doctoral dissertation.
Yeah, I've seen that it was published. I haven't
the Classical Trivium, and where he analyzes Thomas Nash.
Thomas Nash. I've just picked up recently Thomas Nash's what is that called? The Unfortunate Traveler or something like that. Like his novel. I'm really dying to dig into that because that was a huge source for Joyce in Finnegan's Wake as well.
Really, I wasn't aware of that. Interesting.
Yeah.
Have you read? Speaking of Finnegan's Wake, have you read Joseph Campbell's book on Finnegan's Wake?
Skeleton's Key. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
is that? I haven't read it.
That's pretty good. Like, it gets kind of mixed reviews now because people think that there's all these different interpretations in the Wake, of course, right? And people think that Campbell is taking kind of a structural approach to the Wake and trying to make sense of it in his own way, looking at the whole idea of the hero's journey and this kind of monomyth idea, which Campbell got from Finnegan's Wake, right?
Right.
But just seeing it in that way instead of the whole critique of language and everything else, right? Like to try to make sense of the wake in that way, in sort of a narrative way or something, mm-hmm. or even a thematic way,
mm-hmm.
According to this line of criticism, it takes away from the whole crazy interplay of Finnegan's Wake, you know, the crazy linguistic interplay of so many different languages and puns reflecting off of puns.
Right.
That's
very curious, though, because,
right?
I mean, it's interesting to me because, like, the context within which these people would be criticizing Campbell's interpretation is only after he has become this major player in the study of mythology and almost, you know, and but I was very surprised to learn that his writing of that book was one of his first jobs.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that was one of the first books to even try to explain Finnegan's Wake.
I think it was it definitively was the first one, if I'm not
mistaken.
Well,
there's another book that came out earlier, which was Joyce really assembled about 12 different writers that he knew personally, including like Samuel Beckett and people, right?
Uh-huh.
And that's called Our Examination on Our Rectification of blah, 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 Finnegan's Wake, right?
Interesting.
That's a great book. It's a set of essays. And then Joyce even writes in there like his own take, his own kind of, he writes as this country bumpkin or something under a pseudonym and tries to, it puts down the Wake, but in the same, it's really, he's adding a chapter to the Wake. So that book is fascinating because the 12 writers of it are actually the 12 jurors that appear in Finnegan's Wake, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of another chapter of Finnegan's Wake. And so that book starts Finnegan's Wake studies, and then Campbell follows from that. But
gotcha.
it's almost like Joyce started Finnegan's Wake studies as an extension of Finnegan's Wake, right?
Right.
Finnegan's Wake studies start with Finnegan's Wake. It reflects on itself all the way through, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's such a weird thing, you know. It's like so. No, I love that Campbell book, though. You know, it's like,
yeah, I haven't read it, but I've been curious too.
Can I jump in here one second?
Please do, Alan. Please.
So there's an interesting there's a point that you're sort of mentioned or just touched on for a minute, and I feel like this ties back in. So we have McLuhan being the prophet of media on surface level, and then sort of we ignore his own critique of his, you know, bread and butter, right? So it's like, you know, and I don't want to say biting the hand that feeds, but we go to the level of being perhaps misunderstood or critiquing the very thing that you are popularizing, and whether you intend to or not, right?
Right.
And I think of, I've talked about the example of, like, say, like a Miyazaki, you know, critiquing film. I think I've said this to you before, Zenora. Like, there's this interview where he's saying he was making these films to, like, promote nature. All his films, right, are like kids going out into nature and finding these wonders of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, and then the kids are just fall in love with his movies and sit and watch movies. And he's like, fuck. So, you know, he makes another movie to do that, you know, just to show them, no, it's really wonderful. He's like, what am I doing wrong here? Anyway, so I feel like there's this this sort of same idea where we told McLuhan, I've made this comment for, I don't know, the last fucking 10 years that I've been aware of the synchromystic community, where, like, in the early days, all these guys were totally on Terrence McKenna's dick, but at the same time, championing you know, pop culture as this harbinger of you know, this mass ascension or whatever, right? And, like,
right.
You know, McKenna says, hey, culture is not your friend, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So my sort of question had been how, and no one really ever gave me a satisfactory answer. It was like, and I don't know if there is one, it's just sort of an intellectual exercise, how do you rectify those two seemingly opposed realizations? And Zenora, your recent article, I think, just, you know, and again, this is a you know, you're using quotes, which sort of drive home a point that I think really is valuable, in that he is saying there's the possibility that this is a sort of a body, that the collective media is this ascension, this is this mystical revelation, and it's just as possible, if not more so, that it's the exact opposite, that it's our fucking destruction, right? The same,
there's
a Neil Young line, the same thing that makes you live can kill you in the end.
Yeah,
and I, when you, so now I just want to draw one last note into that is, when you say Joyce starts, like right after Finnegan's Wake, the very next step is to pose as the country bumpkin critiquing himself. It's almost to attack the very thing. Does that make sense? Like, okay, so here's this thing, and it's just as possible that I need to fucking attack it because I intended for it to be this wonderful revelation, and it could just as easily be further enslavement, if that makes any sense.
Totally, that makes sense. I think he, and this is something that McLuhan reveals from Joyce, is that Joyce sort of tapped into this, tapped into this whole mechanism of the process of perception, right? And he was one of the first to really nail it, right? And so McLuhan is saying that this is what's going to be used in a world government, right? Like this is exactly what a world government needs to bring together all of the cultures of the world as one. So you can't take like Christianity and impose it on every single culture around the world, and you can't do that with any other culture like Islam or Buddhism or whatever. But what you need to do is show the sort of universal archetypes in all of these cultures and use that as your basis for a world religion, right? And so people are looking at their own religion and saying, oh yeah, but these archetypes reflect in these other religions as well. So do you see what I'm saying? So I think Joyce is really aware of that. He was aware of that right from the beginning. And so in a way that has to happen, like the world has to come together in that way. But on the other hand, it's like, it can be used as a terrible thing, you know?
You're referring to just these collectively understood and, I guess, manifested archetypes that Campbell talks about, that Jung talks about, that McLuhan talks about, that are pervasive in all cultures. You're saying
McLuhan,
sort of unifying field theory to bring all cultures and religions together under one umbrella.
Yeah,
one ring to rule them all.
Yeah, exactly. So McLuhan said Joyce was about the first to really take all of the cultures, all of the languages, everything together at once, and have them sort of simultaneously interpenetrate and interreflect each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, so McLuhan is saying that is what can be used to either liberate us, like bring the world together as, in a mystical sense, like the cosmic body of Christ, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be used as the complete opposite of that, the complete sort of,
as a means of mind control,
Antichrist counterfeit of that. You know, it's like a complete sort of Borg-like acceptance of one rule. You know,
right.
Yeah, one ring, exactly. You know,
I worry that that is already what's going on, in the sense
It's still in play, I think. It hasn't gone exactly one way or the other, and I don't know if it ever will, you know?
I think it's in play. I mean, I agree with you. I think that there are factions, though, within industrial culture that are quite aware of the components that when put together form these, at least the impression or the imprintability of these archetypes and where they geographically may have more impact over others in terms of just culturally. And this is actually gets into one of the central theses of my own or the manifesto that I wrote for my podcast, which I don't know if either of you guys have looked at, but
no,
I can send it to you. But basically, sure. Like, I think, you know, I've always found the whole, the array of archetypes from ranging from Jung and Campbell to McLuhan and how they were put into play into Finnegan's Wake. I've always, and if we're, and I'm really glad, actually, Alan, you mentioned this unified field theory, because I mean, this is something I get into in my opening monologue in the episode one of Fine Just Fine, where I basically say that, or I assert that the answer that physics, that theoretical physics is after in terms of unifying the field, the physical field, actually resides in the realm of media. And specifically all of the media that is used to describe reality.
Right.
And I ask this question, is there a layer, if we're going to run with this physical metaphor, or this metaphor of particle physics as it applies to the realm of media, is there a level beneath the archetypal level? And are there what I like to call these sub-archetypal particles, and which is what I consider to be the particles of language, which are things like symbols and especially the alphabet and numbers or counting systems, not necessarily mathematics in its raw form, but the symbols that we use to express number and quantity. And
it's interesting. I've always wondered that too. If I used to call them just little bits, like bits of
absolutely
bits of language or
bits of information, that, even, you know.
Yeah,
I mean bites, right?
I mean, that's what John Wheeler, the theoretical physicist John Wheeler, made the great phrase "it from bit," where he basically and he's this expert on black holes, and his phrase "it from bit" basically, you know, sums up saying that it's the idealist kind of worldview that of truly mind over matter, that consciousness comes before matter.
Well, Joyce in Finnegan's Wake, he calls it the annihilation of the etym, as in etymologies, etym, instead of the atom, it's the etym, yeah? So these little bits are called etyms, yeah?
Spelled how? How does he spell etym?
E-T-Y-M, like etymologies. Etym.
So okay, Wally, in one of your podcasts, I don't know if it was the pilot part A or part B, you talk about the origin of the word cliché, right, as being
yes.
a mechanical, physical, it's literally like the Gutenberg galaxy, it's the printing press, it's the cliché.
It's the onomatopoeia, it's a French onomatopoeia.
The sound of the printing press of the you know, this sort of machine molding Xerox machine, essentially.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
So, you know what, I'm sort of, my mind's going a few places, but this idea of, like, when we talk about, you know, utilizing the seeds of nature as your ruling sort of philosophy, I'm almost thinking, you know, and just the way media is going is McLuhan has from cliché to archetype, but we're almost going in reverse, where we're archetype to cliché, where we take the thing, you know, we find what seems to be the seed and then propagate that everywhere, mass produce that, what we think of as the lowest common denominator, which maybe gives birth, you know, when that seed blossoms, maybe it gives birth to something completely unexpected.
Well, you're totally describing McLuhan's tetrad right now,
right.
This process of pushing something either to a human innovation, either when pushed to an extreme of its originally intended use, it reverses its properties. But also one of the other aspects of the Tetrad is, you know, what is the innovation obsolesces something, but also retrieves something that had been obsolesced before, right? So, I mean, that's just immediately what comes to mind based on what you're describing right now.
This third part that I'm going to write of these three pieces on McLuhan, I started with his metaphor, the kaleidoscope, which he uses, especially in Gutenberg Galaxy. I don't know if he uses it in other places. I think he does, but he also gets that from Finnegan's Wake. But the idea of a kaleidoscope, when you turn a kaleidoscope, that's what's happening. Like the tetrad is happening when you turn a kaleidoscope. Some pieces in the kaleidoscope are in light, and then other pieces go into shadow. And then you turn it again, and the opposite happens. Those pieces that were in shadow come into light, and it's
right. It's a very binary system.
As it twists, you're seeing no less a complete view in any time of the twist. Like there's no point where it's completely dark, right? But so you're seeing this kaleidoscopic image all the time, right? But it's always different, right? So every moment of history is as complete. There's no real, I think this is what Joyce is getting at, is that there's no real progression where somehow we're getting a more complete view of reality. You know, it's just every
it's
stage
just a slow
of,
churn of the kaleidoscope.
Every stage of history, they had as a complete view as we do now. Although it was completely different at every stage in history, you know, not completely. Some of the elements are the same, right? But the vision was as whole, you know. It's like thinking, comparing your own sort of sensory apparatus to that of an animal or a plant or whatever. The easy way to think of it is that they lack some of the senses that we have, right? But that's not exactly true. Their view of reality is as whole as our view.
Absolutely.
But it's entirely different. It's entirely different. And then once you add media to that in the human human view, human perception, right? Then media changes that too. Some senses are enhanced. Some senses are suppressed in a way. And that changes throughout history as well, you know.
Right.
So when you're mentioning about sort of sub archetypal particles, I started to think, like I was thinking about that myself as well. So it's kind of weird that you're mentioning it, but I was thinking that that's kind of a print view of things, in maybe from McLuhan's perspective, right? Because we're trying to break down these archetypes and to find out the building blocks of them, right? Which is that sort of Newtonian or Newtonian physics or Euclidean geometry view of things that really gets enhanced with print, right?
Yes.
So I guess On one level, maybe that's the case. On another level, maybe from an ear based way of examining it, there'd be no way to break archetypes down. Right?
Well, I'd argue that that's actually an even more fundamental. I mean, that could be considered an even more fundamental level. Like the same. I've been modeling this theory based on particle physics and what I know about particle physics and the standard model and this notion of, to me, like the acoustic, I think is what you're referring to, level, is where is quite literally where you're going to have these vibrating strings, like superstrings of experimental or of theoretical physics, and where you're literally dealing with, you know, sonic impulses or utterances coming from humans and non-humans as well, like other animals, and even plants. Some plants actually create sounds. But basically, these you know, you're having these sonic impulses that are exciting air particles and causing, and that are literally just these vibrating waveforms moving through the medium of air. Those to me, obviously language was first oral, you know, and I consider print or writing, not even print, but just any type of pictorial abstracted representation of language to be further down the chain, really. Like, I mean, to me, it's almost as if those are more like at the molecular level, if we're going to run with this metaphor, than pure aural, A-U-R-L, utterances, right?
Can I make a really like childish, like, well, not you know, like immature, but I think potentially
no judgment, man. Bro crush, right? Bro crush,
right? when you were saying, so obviously there's oral with an O,
right,
from the mouth,
yep.
Oral with an A from the ear,
yep.
But when you said oral, you know, the like teenager me is like, huh. You know, right? So.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But wait. So what I'm thinking is, we have our sort of, you know, the classic like bases of, you know, getting to third base, you know, all these sorts of things, and what we think of as a progression of intimacy. And I was wondering if there's any sort of potential correspondence with sort of as we, at what point do we, so obviously, like, you know, we can't rate a hierarchy of the senses on a normal scale. We're not going to say that the eye is more or less important than the ear, etc. But obviously, to a certain level, we do, in a practical sense. The human experience tells us that there are levels of intimacy depending on our senses.
Well, especially, I think that this is hardly childish. I think that's a pretty complex insight you're offering. I think that, I mean, well, remember, recall what Eric McLuhan said about the eye is the only sense with lids.
Yeah, the
right?
Only sense that you can close.
And to me, the eye is, speaking of childish, the eye is the most kind of immature of the senses in a way, because it is so easily manipulated. It's the easiest sense to trick.
Which is perhaps why it can be closed off is the survival of this, of the animal might depend not only on keeping dust and dirt out of it, which is why we have eyebrows and eyelashes, but the lid would be to protect it. You
to
know,
protect what, the brain and the other senses. The other senses, I feel like, have a much better chance of detecting potentially harmful or threatening thing, you know, a phenomena in within an environment that the eye is susceptible to being misled with, if that makes sense.
And the lids of the eye allow us to sleep and to dream as well, right?
Exactly.
So the eye turns inward, which is interesting, right?
Right. And with the third eye, this whole notion of the third eye is only, you know, you don't really reach enlightenment until you can quote unquote triangulate your vision, you know, or you can perceive three dimensionally in a way with your, because like there's a lot of criticism surrounding vision or the visual sense, in the sense that like, oh, all we care about is we're such a visually based culture and it's all about. Like, the music industry gets constant criticism because it's all about how you look, not about how you sound. Or or women are just these objects of desire and that we ogle, you know, which is a term for to stare at, right? I mean, it's there's so much emphasis on human weakness tied to the sense of sight. So,
yeah, when Alan was talking about oral, the actual word oral, then there's also the sense, I just thought of this when I heard you say this, is it the sense of ore, like the sense of an ore or ore as gold, you know, it's like
mining, O-R-E?
Yeah, I mean, even or itself, or is French for gold, right? It's like a lot of the Latin
also the preposition
are...
or is it denotes choice.
Yeah, interesting too. So then if you think like this, so the oral period is actually the age of gold in a way too, right? Like it's the
mm-hmm.
our primitive past, right? Like
absolutely.
The age of Saturn.
And the letter R, which is or, is I think I get into that in my first episode when I talk with my buddy who's a speech pathologist about the and my old band. MirthCon had a capital R in its spelling, and I had a whole mythology built around this idea of the letter R being this sound of aggression.
R, yeah,
exactly.
It's the pirate sound, too.
It's the
right?
pirate
so it's
sound.
The,
and
it's the freebooters, yeah.
Well, what's really interesting is that it is physically requires the most complex coordination of muscles in the palate. Mm. In order to produce. Mm. And when you consider that from an evolutionary perspective, you know, resources that are that, or any action that is that demanding of resources are reserved for the most dire, desperate situations, right?
Mm.
And in very early, early evolutionary history. And this is kind of the wacky angle I like to approach a lot of this stuff is, what's the evolutionary basis for using certain phonemes? Or for using certain symbols, and why, which contributed more or less to an entire culture's fitness and ability to thrive or lack or not.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been reading also about tantra, right, in the Indian tradition, right, but. Yeah, not only the sexual aspect to it, but just that of what you just said is that how every phoneme in Tantra has a sort of mandalic image associated with it.
Absolutely.
And also a god associated with that.
Absolutely.
Right? So
yeah.
It's like a phoneme is a god, you know. Each one of these letters that we keep speaking with or writing with is like we're constantly saying the names of gods.
Right. Well, think of the Om phoneme. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
That's
and
like...
the Om in Tantra, like that whole tradition, the Om brings all of these together, right? All of these phonemes that it's
right.
It's like the
well. What's really interesting about
all phonemes, right?
About Om.
there was a quote from. George Harrison, right? He's got that song "My Sweet Lord," right? And he
Lord, yeah, there it is again.
Right. Well, right. So, like, throughout, like, there's like the background singers going like Hare Krishna, right, and all that sort of stuff, right? So he said, I remember reading an interview with him. He was saying his idea with that song is that people sing along with the music. So he's like, I'm gonna basically. I can't get people to chant these mantras, which I want them to chant, like, as part of his spiritual practice, right? That if you chant these, a large part of this is, of Eastern tradition, is the idea that you actually have to say, just like how Finnegan's Wake is perhaps meant to be sung, the same idea that you have these, a lot of, like, Vedic texts that are not meant to be read, they're meant to be sung. So his idea was he encodes this into a song, and people are then, like, basically he's tricking them into doing this spiritual practice. Huh. And the only other time, you know, so take this in whatever way you want. I don't mean this as, like, a literal satanic thing, but, you know, whatever, right? So what one guy's getting you to sing Hare Krishna, but another guy might get you to sing something else. I was at a... You guys know the band Cake?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went to a Cake concert once, and they have a song called Satan Is My Motor.
Yep, I know that
okay?
song. Yep.
And so the concert's going. It was actually a very disappointing concert, but whatever. So, okay. I have to say I like them, but
yeah, me too.
I like them a lot, but the concert was disappointing. Anyway, they get to that song, And it was the only song where they did this, where they just like sat on the chorus for like a really long time and had like the audience singing along. So the, like, I mean, it went on for so long that I'm like looking around at like my friends being like, is this like still happening? Where they just have the whole audience going, Satan is my motor. Satan is my motor. And it was going for so long. I'm just like, I'm like, all my friends, like, again, I'm not like,
they're proving a point, for sure.
Like a Christian, like, oh my God. It was more just like a, this isn't entertaining. What is this?
They're creating a motor.
Right.
I mean, they're creating, what is a motor other than something that constantly iterates the same basic pattern? Right? I mean, a motor is just iterating.
It's a cycle stuck, right? It's a spinning perpetual motion.
I mean, the very opening of Frank Zappa's last album that he created while he was still alive, called Civilization Phase 3, is the secret is you got to put a motor in yourself, and then it would kick into a song. I mean, I think that...
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this idea of creating the motor, you know, some people, who is it that... was it McLuhan that thinks that the invention of the combustion engine is, you know, marked the beginning of the end of human civilization? I don't know if it was McLuhan, or it might have been like Ezra Pound, or I forget who. No, or damn it, who was it?
Yeah, I don't know if I've heard that before.
Maybe it was Ted Kaczynski, actually.
Well, it sounds like something from Jacques Ellul. I'm not sure if he said that, but Kaczynski was really into that guy. Have you guys read Ellul?
No, I've read Kaczynski's manifesto, which is pretty fucked up.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It is interesting.
His manifesto, but Ellul writes, his most famous one is Technological Society, and it's a critique of technique, what he calls technique, which includes all technology. It sounds like something he might have said.
Yeah, it's possible. I'm trying to remember, man, who said that? It's not McLuhan. It's got to be, it doesn't really matter, but it's funny, you know, Alan, your story about the cake concert reminds me of, have you ever seen the film The Burbs with Tom Hanks?
Sure, yeah.
Remember the scene when Rick Dukeman is showing him the book of, like, ritual killings and or whatever. They're, like, down in the basement, and he's showing him the book of all the demonic stuff. And Tom Hanks' character is plugging his ears. He's like, I'm not listening to this, you know. And Rick Dukeman's like, Ray, you're chanting, listen. You're chanting, I want to kill everyone. Satan is good. Satan is my pal. And then he's like, once they get in here, pal, and he's pointing at his forehead, it's over, pal. You know, it's... but it's the same idea. I think that's exactly what the cake concert was doing, is just like, people will do anything.
Right. I mean, that's just it. I look at that moment and I don't... You know, it's certainly possible, and I gave the George Harrison example to say, it's certainly possible that, okay, someone in the band is a Satanist or whatever, and that was, they had the same plan as George Harrison. I'm going to trick you into following what I believe is a spiritual path, right? Essentially what McLuhan was accusing Ezra Pound and Joyce of, right? It's spiritual warfare hidden in the arts. How dare you, you know, use your art to make me sing Hare Krishna, and how dare you use your art to make me sing Satan is my motor. So there's the potential there for that. And yes, there's also the potential of me being a quasi-rock star going, let me see if I, you know, will they fall for it? Like, will people do this? Mm-hmm. Like, will anybody be upset? Will anybody protest? Will anybody be offended? Can we create a controversy? Whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a million explanations. It's just fascinating.
Well, it's almost like the Milgram experiment is almost, in a way, it reminds me of, you know, this idea of, or just, you know, groupthink. And man, I've been at
metal shows when I was a teenager, back in the day when I was like way into like thrash metal and stuff, and just what the crowd will do when like there's a woman crowd surfing, and it's like, you know, they'll just there's no shame to just like rip off her clothes and totally like, or like, you know, grope her, like, you know, and it's almost like she just has to you know, she signed up for it by crowd surfing, and it's just kind of like totally, you know, no big deal, you know, or just like this kind of group behavior that can manifest when, especially if everybody thinks that they're having a good time, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes with crowd surfing, you have no choice, so you get hoisted up there, and then you.
That's true. That's true. Absolutely.
But yeah, I've seen that happen too. Like, just girls getting groped totally.
And you know, it's almost as if like they were expecting it, and it's like.
Well, they went into the pit. They made that choice, at least.
Right, you know? Right.
Yeah.
It's like, why aren't you groping me? You know, what does that say about my?
Well, so I mean, that's it's a sort of bold sort of area to go in.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, who am I to really make? You know, obviously, I'm not.
I'm not necessarily. Trying to shut down what you're saying. I'm just saying, like, think about that in the context of, you know, the conversations that are happening, in the sense of, you know, just because I wear this doesn't mean you treat me a certain way.
Sure.
But, you know, as fucked up as this is, medium is the message, right? Like,
yep.
You know, if...
Yeah, we're getting
this is
touchy territory here.
Here's like a serious, like, again, just, you know, experiment. You know, if you walk down the street conservatively dressed, like completely covered up, but wore a shirt that said, like, I'm a slut. You know, how would people, do you know what I'm saying? Like, what are you saying? Is it an ironic statement? Is it, what is that? What are you inviting? All these sorts of questions, and what... is the, when we say we're reading into things, I mean, that's literally, we're talking about the complexities of literacy, a multi-contextual literacy.
Well, wearing anything with text on it, you could ask the same question. Like, what is the point of clothing that is meant to, is, you know, designed to be read as a kind of bonus feature of just the basic function of clothing?
Well, it's... in Japan, there's this whole, well, I guess it's been going on for a long time, but it just, this trend of people, usually younger people, wearing t-shirts or whatever with just random crazy English words on their t-shirts, and just mixed in a way that no English-speaking person would ever come up with the combinations of words. It's totally absurd.
Yeah, my wife has a bunch of them. They're hilarious.
They're amazing, right?
It's like a cut-up technique. I wonder how intentional or unintentional is that? Did someone think it actually... Because sometimes there's like sentences like mixed in with the words, but the sentences are so butchered. It's like, did someone think that was how you translated that, or does it just not matter?
Yeah, I don't know.
And how perceptive of... You know, someone else to say, well, I just want to have the English words on the t-shirt. It doesn't really matter what it says.
Right.
You get the idea. And then here we are in sort of our own little grammar Nazis, or just, again, how our minds, the, you know, what's some have referred to, right, the virus of literacy, is we're saying, this doesn't make sense. It's absurd.
Well, I think there's a similar tendency, though, in like people getting tattoos in Chinese that, vaguely, correctly to what they think it means, you know. I think it's a similar trend, just manifesting slightly differently.
My wife and I, we've been to Bangkok, and people are wearing a t-shirt in Japanese, like foreign people, like English-speaking people, probably wearing a t-shirt which says in Japanese, "I'm a public toilet." Yeah,
wow,
kind of. But yeah, here's an example of the weird stuff here. This is a T-shirt I saw a while back. The chance is here only once. The sought one is surely found. Quebec.
That is deep.
Oh, that's high poetry.
Yeah, that is yeah. It's wow.
Insane, but,
Garth, and, that was a haiku. So
I asked people about that, and they don't even register that they have that anybody should be reading it at all. You know, it's like that.
I have a serious problem. So going with the idea of the experiment that you know, the cake rock star, you know, trying to pull off an experiment. I have a serious suggestion. What if, Zenor, what if we collected a bunch of text off these Japanese T-shirts and wrote them down and we printed a book of poetry? Like totally highbrow the shit out of it. Using phrases found on these T-shirts.
There's sort of a poetic movement, I can't remember what it's called, it's sort of a recent poetic movement that does that kind of thing, right? It just... You know how sometimes you get these email messages and it's just all garbled text, and sometimes you find all this random words.
Yes, dude, I started believing that those things were like serious messages.
Yeah, so people have done that where they take those like spam, like I forget what the name is for that, like a word spam or something like that, and they mix it together as poetry, and
totally.
So it's kind of already happening. I don't know if they take stuff from Japanese T-shirts, but yeah, that would be a good source for it. You know,
what's interesting too.
I use it as a kind of like synchro messages to myself. You know, and I wrote this one down because I think, fuck, maybe I should go to Quebec. You know,
totally. Like Quebec is pretty amazing.
It's here only once.
Yeah, I get these emails sometimes where, like, I open it up and it just looks like a standard, like, hey, my name is, you know, Tatiana. I'm a 23-year-old Russian looking for a noble man or whatever, like, you know. But the thing is, like, there's all of this extra text hidden inside the message that's, like, really, really...
Yeah, yeah.
Because the message is formatted like HTML, but in between the words... are these super tiny fonts of other words. And when I was even more paranoid back in the day, I actually was like, you know, pulling these things apart and being like, what the hell is this? And thinking it was some kind of like, you know, I don't know. And, you know, secret conspiratorial messaging system. But of course, it's just a way that they populate their messages with this nonsense in order to get through spam filters. Basically, is what I've learned.
Yeah.
But what's crazy is that they, in addition, I just found one. I'm going to see if I can post this. In addition to all of these extra words that they put in, there's this, totally obscure, but pretty uncommon, like, Chinese symbol system that is called Yi, spelled the letter Y-I. I don't know if that rings a bell with either of y'all. But here, I'm going to copy a couple of these. They almost look like runes or you can't barely see them. Let me do a screenshot.
Oh, yeah, I can. Yeah.
So
little weird sigils or something.
Yeah. So here, check this out. I like zoomed way in. Okay, screenshot. And then I wish I could do a faster. Okay, wait, here we go. All right, here it comes. So, you guys see that?
Okay. Yeah.
So this is all of the hidden, like the gray text is the text that you normally see. And then the brownish stuff is what is usually hidden.
Okay.
Underneath it, apprehensive be wailing.
Yeah, dude, there are some of the word, the English
damn
words.
Progressiveness, yeah.
And this is just a random little screenshot of the excerpt I pull up.
Greece dangerous, bedem progressiveness, unapprehensive be wailing.
Yeah, it's cool. And in the middle of it all is, hey there, gorgeous, my name is Ethel. You know, it's like, And then all these totally bizarre-looking sigil things that I've discovered are this kind of obscure symbol set that for a certain dialect in Chinese that was invented in like 600 AD. I just and sometimes what you can do is that these will translate into these. It's a Chinese syllabary called Yi.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and I went so far once as to look up each individual symbol, what syllable they represent, and you can type in the syllables in Latin text into Google Translate, and it will translate it into Chinese. And I got some really wacky stuff.
Oh, is it? I wonder if it's like an alternate version of like kanji, where it's like where it says it's a syllable and an entire word at the same time.
It might be. It might be. But it's definitely a syllabary, and I never really got anything very coherent to come out of it. So
I'm just curious if you're able to put that character into Google Translate and get something.
No, I can't. What I have to do is I have to do a Google search of each individual symbol, there's actually this website, I forget what it's, Graph or Glyphtastic or something like that. Anyway, there's a place that will totally tell you what syllable it is in Latin text. So, like, there's one for, like, F-G-U or Fugu or something like, you know, weird, just to a Westerner, they just sound like nonsensical almost, just these little morphemes of text. But I would just find each one and then type in as if it's almost like pinyin into Google Translate in English text or in Latin text, and it would convert that as like a pinyin syllabary into Chinese. I mean, I could try to do a couple right now.
No, I mean, I get, because it could be just as random as bedem and progressiveness.
No, I know, it is. So far, I have not really been able to find...
Wailing waitress. Wailing waitresses.
Yeah,
but this is the kind of stuff that Philip K. Dick was into. You know, it's like just finding weird messages like that and then translating them into deeply meaningful things. You know.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that you can. I mean, that's the whole mystery of the use of symbols is that once you just decide that this symbol represents something, you can create any message you want.
you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune into our other SyncBook Radio programs, including 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathmagical Radio Hour, Pentimental, Synchronize, Sync Quick News, as well as our most recent editions, Fine Just Fine and Hypnosis. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.